From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special report taking a closer look at Baltimore, past and present.
I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard.
Ironically, it was only 2 days after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, that the then governor of Maryland, Spiro T. Agnew, who would become the Republican nominee for vice president later that year, declared a state of emergency over an uprising in Baltimore.
We have taken the following steps to restore law and order in our state, and you may be sure that the situation is under control and under constant vigilance of state and local authorities. We have proclaimed a state of emergency in Baltimore City and Baltimore County. A curfew has been imposed in Baltimore City from 4 p.m. to 6 a.m. and in Baltimore County from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. except for officially approved emergency reasons. I have ordered state offices in Baltimore City and Baltimore County closed at 2 p.m. tomorrow to comply with an early curfew should that be necessary. And I have requested the business community to do the same. State employees who are residents of Baltimore City and County, but who work in other subdivisions, will also be released at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Executive orders have been issued prohibiting the sale of alcoholic beverages, firearms, ammunition, flammable materials, and liquids in Baltimore City and Baltimore County. The sale of alcoholic beverages is also banned in Anne Arundel and Howard counties. Every available unit of the Maryland National Guard has been fully mobilized and deployed within the city. In addition, at 6:11 this evening, I requested federal reinforcements to further secure the city. Attorney General Ramsey Clark agreed to immediately dispatch the troops. They should now be taking positions in the critical areas. These steps have been taken to control violence, save lives and property, and to bring about a swift restoration of order. I want to commend the overwhelming majority of our citizens, white and black, who have remained calm in these hours of crisis. I ask you to continue this example, to remain at home and obey the curfew. Even during the daylight hours, I strongly suggest limiting your activities so that your police, National Guard, and fire department may perform effectively. I urge all parents to exercise vigilance over their children. In the affected area, much of the lawlessness to date has been caused by unruly and unsupervised youths. Other youngsters whose conduct has been responsible and admirable could be endangered even by the most innocent sightseeing. To all who have been victimized, I pledge to you that all possible power will be exerted to restore order and security to your lives and to assist those made homeless by fire. To those few who loot and burn, we shall show no sympathy, nor will we tolerate those few who would take the law into their own hands. We have local police, state police, and federalized troops on the scene, in control, working effectively. We ask for no citizen volunteers, only common sense from our citizens. While today we are pressed to confront force with force, to put down violence and douse fires, the lessons of these past hours have not been lost on any of us. We know now, as never before, how vital is the law to our liberty. We know now, as never before, that violence is no friend to freedom. And and that the mob is no ally of civil rights. We know now, as we've always known, that where rightful grievances exist, we must redress them with speed and compassion. We know now that to move ahead, we must never stand still. We must not stand still for a violation of our laws, nor must we stand still for conditions which create hopelessness or despair. We must press on at once for the good jobs, the good housing, the good education, for all those of our citizens who have been long denied these opportunities. Let us rededicate ourselves to the unfinished business, not out of fear of reprisal, but out of certain faith that it is right.
There was a strong backlash against the uprising, with many calling for the National Guard to shoot what the press called looters and outside agitators. But the response was one of relative restraint, as articulated by the then Adjutant General George M. Gelston.
General, there has been some criticism about the way the forces at your command handled the looting here. It's been suggested that force should have been met with force.
I can just say that I wish the decision was as simple to me as it is to those people who would not be required to live by their decision. There are a number of factors involved when you come to considering force that I think perhaps people forget. And the first one is the value of life. What value do you attach to life? Is a loaf of bread or a pint of whiskey or a scorched suit or a pair of shoes worth a life? Now, I have 11,000 troops deployed in this city. And it would be up to each one of those individuals to make that decision. And I submit that this is a decision that even the wisest man would have difficulty in making under tense circumstances. Another thing is, we know from experience that when there is defying and indiscriminate firing, that more innocent people have been killed than have the guilty ones. And unfortunately, those that perhaps should be killed almost invariably get away. If you can say anybody should be killed, and I'm not advocating that.
Most of that history seems to be missing from the media narrative in the current crisis in Baltimore. This was the current governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, at a press conference Monday.
We're here in our Emergency Operations Command Center, which has now been activated. All state agencies are actively engaged in this situation. We've partnered with Baltimore City and all other agencies in Maryland, as well as neighboring states. This evening, as a result of the serious violence and looting which has led to the destruction of property and put innocent Marylanders at significant risk, I have declared a state of emergency at the request of Baltimore City. This order deploys the Maryland National Guard in order to help restore order and to end the unrest that we witnessed today and tonight. I have not made decision lightly. The National Guard represents a last resort in order to restore order. Look, people have the right to protest and express their frustration, but Baltimore City families deserve peace and safety in their communities, and these acts of violence and destruction of property cannot and will not be tolerated. I strongly condemn the actions of those who engaged in direct attacks against innocent civilians, businesses, and law enforcement officers. The resources of the State Police and the National Guard have already been deployed in support of all law enforcement in the city. They will exercise disciplined restraint and provide the support necessary to ensure safety and to bring law and order to Baltimore City. We've got our entire team here. I'm going to turn the podium over here for a moment to Colonel William Palazzi, who's the superintendent of our state police. And then we will hear from General Linda Singh, and who's the adjutant general of the Maryland National Guard, and also Clay Stamp, who is the director of the Maryland Emergency Management Agency, where we are here tonight. So I'm going to start now with Colonel Palazzi of the State Police, and then we'll be happy to take your questions after everybody has spoken. Thank you.
Good evening. As the governor said, I'm Colonel William Palazzi, superintendent of the State Police, and the governor's actions today are huge. We have been here, along with many of our allied law enforcement, over 500 strong, since Wednesday, working with the city of Baltimore in various capacities, helping to maintain as much order as possible. As you've seen, many groups continue to splinter and move around the city of Baltimore, looting, you know, committing crimes in certain areas, setting places on fire. Our mission has been and will continue to be the preservation of life and the preservation of property. I have had conversations this evening with Commissioner Batts. He certainly understands the scope of what has happened and that we're coming in with additional forces to assist. The governor's statement of declaration of the emergency order is big in that it allows us to branch out even further. We've already put out a request for up to 500 additional law enforcement from the state of Maryland regionally to come out and provide assistance. But through an EMAC request, which the MEMOP director will talk about in a little bit, we're putting out a request for up to 5,000 law enforcement from the regional area in the Mid-Atlantic to assist us as well. We are asking that they be equipped with the necessary equipment for their own personal safety, as well as to assist us in deploying things. You know, kind of a plan in the next few hours is to be work with other local law enforcement leaders, kind of divide up the city into certain sectors, on which we will then go sector by sector trying to protect, starting ideally with the hottest areas first, which we're waiting for that briefing from BPD right now, and then work in concert with the National Guard as they come on board to maintain security of those areas. At this time, it's all I have.
Thank you, Colonel. Now we're going to turn the floor over to Clay Stamp, who is the director of the Maryland Emergency Management Agency.
Thank you, Governor. Ladies and gentlemen, the governor's been clear from day one. We activated this past Saturday in his direction to integrate our actions with the city of Baltimore as they dealt with this situation. We've had over 400 state policing agencies in the city working with them. Today turned another chapter, and as the governor said, he declared a state of emergency. This was done after the mayor of Baltimore declared a state of emergency. That means that they've exceeded their capability, and they actually need help from the state of Maryland to move in and to support their efforts to curb the situation. What you see here is a full court press. You see representatives from organizations across the state agency, as well as volunteer organizations. They're bringing the full weight of the state government to deliver resources to achieve the governor's goals, which are clear. We will be working diligently in our different sections that are activated, transportation support, law enforcement, health and medical, human services, and through planning, logistics, and operations, we will achieve the necessary results we need to achieve, again, the governor's directive. I'll turn it over to Governor Hogan again. Thank you, sir.
Lastly, before we take your questions, we're going to turn the podium over here to General Linda Singh, who is the Adjutant General of the Maryland Guard.
Thank you, Governor. As the governor mentioned, the Maryland Guard is actually going to be out in activation this evening. And what you need to understand is that he has access to our full complement that's here within the state, which means up to about 5,000 troops that can be put onto the streets to actually protect property and people. I would highly recommend that we all go in and take cover for the night and actually go to sleep and get some rest and let things settle down so that we can restore order to the city. We are going to be out in massive force, and that just basically means that we are going to be patrolling the streets and out to ensure that we're protecting property. We are in a supporting mode, so if there are any questions about martial law, this is not martial law. Martial law means that at that point the military fully takes over, so we are not at that point. I repeat, not at that point. We are in support of the police department, and we will be taking our direction from the police department as in where we're going to go out and support. Thank you.
This time we all be happy to take any questions that anyone might have. Any questions?
So there we hear from equipment sources that there is an officer that is gravely injured in the vehicle. What's your perspective?
Well, I've heard about some of the officers have been injured. I haven't heard the exact medical status, but if there anybody else that can address that, I don't think you probably have more up-to-date information than we do. I can tell you that the last report I had were 7 police officers were injured. It's something, as I said earlier, that won't be tolerated. It was one of the factors in us deciding we had to get in there and provide some support, I can tell you that. But we'll let you know as soon as we... Does anybody here have any other updated information on the health? We'll try to get you the answer.
Governor, with all the resources being thrown, who is actually in charge and will direct where the resources are going and what to do next?
Well, the city has asked for us to take over. Currently, the state police superintendent, Bill Palazzi, is in charge. We'll be in direct communication with the city, with the mayor, with the city police, and General Singh will be providing backup assistance to the state police. We'll be coordinating the police from other counties around the state and from the other police that we get in from around other states in the region.
Governor, when we put out that we declared the state of emergency and the National Guard is coming in, a lot of the response we got was, finally, what took so long? What was the tipping point for you that made you declare the state of emergency?
We declared the state of emergency and I issued the executive order less than 30 seconds after requested by the city of Baltimore. So it didn't take us very long at all. I signed an executive order almost immediately as soon as we received the call and then called the president. There was no delay whatsoever. We've had this emergency operations center activated since Saturday. We've had hundreds of state police on the ground. We've had every single state agency and local agency coordinated out of this operation already for the entire week. I've been in daily communication with the mayor and others in the city, and our entire team has been involved from day one. But frankly, this is a Baltimore City situation. Baltimore City was in charge. When the mayor called me, which quite frankly we were glad that she finally did, is instantly we signed the executive order. We already had our entire team prepared. In fact, I'd already called General Singh earlier in the day and asked her to get prepared to be called up. We were all in the command center in the second floor of the State House. In constant communication, and we were trying to get in touch with the mayor for quite some time. She finally made that call, and we immediately took action.
Governor, do you think that you should have gotten a call earlier? Would you have liked to have acted earlier?
Look, I don't want to. I know that the city has done everything in their power to get this under control. I don't want to question what they've been doing. They're all under tremendous stress. We're all here on one team, and I want to thank the mayor for all of her involvement. We're just happy that we're all on the same page and we're all able to help each other at this point.
Governor, can you detail for us what the National Guard is capable of that Baltimore City has not?
Well, I'll let General Singh talk about maybe whatever some of the specifics that she can. But again, the National Guard is going to provide some assets and be working as backup to the state police and the other police agencies. So we're not, as she said, we haven't taken over. It's not a situation where they're going to be in charge, but we are going to roll in some assets into the city. We're going to have some equipment and some manpower that's going to help us get the situation under control. But I'll let General Singh talk about what assets they have available and what might be happening. And keep in mind that some assets will be readily available and we'll get down there tonight. Some of them take a while to call up and get in. So it'll be growing as we bring in folks from around various counties around the state, as we call up the Guard members, and as we get support from other states. But we're going to get as much as we can there this evening.
If I could talk to that real quick, one of the challenges law enforcement's had is the moving. Like, we've been able to go in with BPD, go in and stop certain areas and moving. As they constantly move around, they outnumber us. So I can tell you my ask of the National Guard is to allow us to come in when we clear an area, hold that area. But we need it for everybody, for law enforcement and National Guard, for it to be done as safely as possible. They need to have the proper equipment to defend themselves, to secure themselves from rocks and bottles and everything else that's being thrown at us. That's one of the biggest requests of the National Guard from law enforcement is hold certain critical infrastructure, certain areas that we believe we need to hold.
President Obama was asked about the situation in Baltimore at a press conference Tuesday.
As you know, the National Guard is now on the streets of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. The latest aftermath in a series of what have been high-profile confrontations between black men and police officers. And there seems to be growing frustration among African-American leaders that not enough is being done quickly enough. Mark Morial of the Urban League said the U.S. is in a state of emergency of tremendous proportions. The president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says we are in the throes of a national crisis. Are we in the throes of a national crisis? What are you prepared to do about it, both in terms of Baltimore and the larger picture? And what do you say to critics who say that since the death of Trayvon Martin, you have not been aggressive enough in your response?
Let me make a couple of points. First, obviously, our thoughts continue to be with the family of Freddie Gray. Understandably, they want answers. And the DOJ has opened an investigation. It is working with local law enforcement to find out exactly what happened, and I think there should be full transparency and accountability. Second, my thoughts are with the police officers who were injured in last night's disturbances. It underscores that that's a tough job, and we have to keep that in mind. And my hope is that they can heal and get back to work as soon as possible. Point number three, there's no excuse for the kind of violence that we saw yesterday. It is counterproductive. When individuals get crowbars and start prying open doors to loot, they're not protesting. They're not making a statement. They're stealing. When they burn down a building, they're committing arson. And they're destroying and undermining businesses and opportunities in their own communities that rob jobs and opportunity from people in that area. So it is entirely appropriate that the mayor of Baltimore, who I spoke to yesterday, and the governor, who I spoke to yesterday, work to stop that kind of senseless violence and destruction. That is not a protest. That is not a statement. It's people, a handful of people, taking advantage of a situation for their own purposes, and they need to be treated as criminals. Point number four, the violence that happened yesterday distracted from the fact that you had seen multiple days of peaceful protests that were focused on entirely legitimate concerns of these communities in Baltimore, led by clergy and community leaders, and they were constructive and they were thoughtful, and frankly didn't get that much attention. And one burning building will be looped on television over and over and over again, and the thousands of demonstrators who did it the right way, I think, have been lost in the discussion. The overwhelming majority of the community in Baltimore, I think, have handled this appropriately, expressing real concern and outrage over the possibility that our laws were not applied evenly in the case of Mr. Gray, and that accountability needs to exist. And I think we have to give them credit. My understanding is you've got some of the same organizers now going back into these communities to try to clean up in the aftermath of a handful of protesters, a handful of criminals and thugs who tore up the place. What they were doing, what those community leaders and clergy and others were doing, that is a statement. That's the kind of organizing that needs to take place if we're going to tackle this problem. And they deserve credit for it, and we should be lifting them up. point number five, and I've got six, because this is important. Since Ferguson and the task force that we put together, we have seen too many instances of what appears to be police officers interacting with individuals, primarily African-American, often poor, in ways that raise troubling questions. And it comes up, it seems like, once a week now, or once every couple of weeks. And so I think it's pretty understandable why the leaders of civil rights organizations, but more importantly, moms and dads across the country might start saying, this is a crisis. What I'd say is, this has been a slow rolling crisis. This has been going on for a long time. This is not new. And we shouldn't pretend that it's new. The good news is that perhaps there's some newfound awareness because of social media and video cameras and so forth that there are problems and challenges when it comes to how policing and our laws are applied in certain communities, and we have to pay attention to it and respond. What's also good news is the task force that was made up of law enforcement and community activists that we brought together here in the White House have come up with very constructive, concrete proposals that, if adopted by local communities and by states and by counties, by law enforcement generally, would make a difference. Wouldn't solve every problem, but would make a concrete difference in rebuilding trust and making sure that the overwhelming majority of effective, honest, and fair law enforcement officers, that they're able to do their job better because it will weed out or retrain or put a stop to those handful who may be not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, the challenge for us as the federal government is that we don't run these police forces. I can't federalize every police force in the country and force them to retrain. But what I can do is to start working with them collaboratively so that they can begin this process of change themselves. And we, coming out of the task force that we put together, we're now working with local communities. Department of Justice has just announced a grant program for those jurisdictions that want to purchase body cameras. We are going to be issuing grants for those jurisdictions that are prepared to start trying to implement some of the new training and data collection and other things that can make a difference. And we're going to keep on working with those local jurisdictions so that they can begin to make the changes that are necessary. I think it's going to be important for organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police and other police unions and organizations to acknowledge that this is not good for police. We have to own up to the fact that occasionally there are going to be problems here, just as there are in every other occupation. There are some bad politicians who are corrupt. There are folks in the business community or on Wall Street who don't do the right thing. Well, there's some police who aren't doing the right thing. And rather than close ranks, you know, what we've seen is a number of thoughtful police chiefs and commissioners and others recognize they got to get their arms around this thing and work together with the community to solve the problem.
We'll have more on the situation in Baltimore tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.